You for this hour that we have together to think about a topic that doesn't normally come up, maybe on a Sunday morning, but certainly is one that we are quite aware of. We see it on our streets, in our parks, right of ways. We wonder about the extended nature of it. We're saddened by it. I thank you that your word, your people have a lot to say and opportunities to serve, and may you help us to explore those in this next hour and next week as well. In Christ's name we pray, amen. All right, well, thank you for coming to a Sunday school class on a pretty bizarre topic, right, for a Sunday school, homelessness. You probably didn't expect to see that in your bulletin this morning. But we thought the session and the pastors thought that this could be a helpful topic for us as believers in this period in our history, the 21st century, with such a obvious social crisis of homelessness, to delve into it as believers, to see what the Bible may have to say about it, to understand it better. And so my objective and hope is that we'll understand the types and causes of homelessness, and then, as I alluded to, what does the church, what do Christians maybe have to offer in the way of some solutions to address this issue. And if nothing else, to know how to pray for those who are kind of on the front lines and serving the homeless. Just a little bit about my background, why I'm up here. Some of you may know. I had the opportunity to serve in the state Senate, and I was thinking about the sermon this morning. And in this respect, I was elected to the Senate. I was the vote that gave my party the majority. It was a pretty heady moment in my life to be able to serve in that way and to be in the majority. And what did the Lord do? But he placed me as the chair of the Human Services Committee. That was not a terribly appealing or popular committee to be on, because it dealt with things like Department of Corrections and mental health and addiction treatment, homelessness. So, and I had no background in those areas. I was a lawyer, private practice for a number of years. And what I found, though, was that not very many people in the Senate or the House, for that matter, knew anything about mental health from a policy standpoint. And so I just tried to learn everything I could so that I could be more effective at my role as the chair, and then I could advise my caucus and other legislators on public policy issues that dealt with homelessness and mental health and addiction and so forth. So that's how I got in this area. I don't have a clinical background. Some of you may have that, but I fell into it in this policy way, and I see just the Lord's hand in sort of giving me an opportunity to learn and serve in this area. And I have to admit, I probably wouldn't have chosen to focus on this area had the Lord not put me in that position on that particular committee. Then I worked for our county executive for 7 years, and my role was to help stand up and drive some new behavioral health initiatives. By the way, behavioral health, I'll use that term today and next week. That's a shorthand reference to two areas. One is mental health. Usually we're talking about pretty serious mental health, kind of the deep end of the pool, as it were, when you think of people who suffer from serious chronic mental health issues, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, severe depression. And then it also refers to substance use disorder and what policy and efforts we have at a state and local level to try to address those issues. That's behavioral health, those two things. I'll be referring to that. So I, for 7 years, had the privilege of working for a county executive on his team to stand up some new behavioral health initiatives. So for the last 12, 13 years, that's what I've been doing, primarily, is working in that space. And it wasn't too long as I started thinking about how we can improve our behavioral health system that I started working in the homeless space. Because, as we'll see in a few minutes, much of what we see in the nature of visible homelessness or chronic homelessness, and I'll define those terms in a few minutes, is the result of really untreated mental illness and addiction. I want to do a kind of a thought experiment here. So think of some other times when Christians in the church have responded to social crises, profound needs within a larger society that might not necessarily get addressed by those in power who are more interested, as our sermon from Stephen mentioned, those who go into power tend to want more dominant, influential roles. And there are some things that just don't get addressed very well in most of societies. And Christians have responded. Can you think of some examples of that? I've got several, and you'll probably pick the ones I picked. Mike. Okay, so the first CareNet was... were Christians back in the early, Mike was saying, when Christians began to be a movement, and the Roman culture was about power and strength, very, very uninterested in unborn life or even born life. Slavery was everywhere. That was one very clear way that the Christians responded was to save the newly born from infanticide.
Salvation Army.
Okay, Salvation Army. So Salvation Army does a lot of things. That's a great example. So they have responded in this space of homelessness and people who need shelter, those who need help with various social services. What else? Habitat for Humanity, which... a lot of folks don't know. It's a faith-based organization. So Habitat for Humanity, as most of you will know, is housing for people who are struggling to be housed, but it actually gives them a stake at home ownership. Yeah. Food banks, okay. So people who are struggling to provide food for themselves or their families, Christian food banks. Okay. So Amy Carmichael orphanages all around the world in different places. Just maybe one more, Peter, and then. Okay. All right. Some of you have stole my thunder, but like you just did, Peter. Thank you. But let me talk about hospitals, and we'll talk.
What did he say?
He said hospitals, and I did want to talk a little bit more about hospitals and about orphanages. So great call outs there. First, hospitals. So I mentioned Roman times when we talked about infanticide. The Roman Empire didn't have hospitals. They were, if you got sick, there wasn't much for you because you weren't contributing to the Pax Romana. It was Christians who started the first hospitals in the Byzantine period, so about the 3rd or 4th century. This is when, by that time, Christianity had become much more influential and ultimately became the official religion under Constantine. So the first hospitals were founded by Christians. I'm intrigued by the name of Presbyterian Hospital. Presbyterian Hospital in New York is one of the more dominant hospital systems. It's combined with another hospital system, but it was founded in 1868 by James Lennox, who was a Scottish Presbyterian influential. Made a lot of important gifts to Princeton University, was one of the first presidents of the American Bible Society, started a Presbyterian hospital. This is what Christians do. There are these social needs, and our impulse, I think it's in our DNA, is to try to meet that social need in a meaningful way. And then we talked about, who started the first hospital in the Northwest? Anybody might know that? Yep, of course, a physician would know. The Sisters of Providence in 1858, So long before we were a state, the Sisters of Providence were started our first hospital. Orphanages was mentioned. First known orphanage started by Christians, again, was in the Byzantine period in the 4th century. And we've all heard or read about George Mueller in Bristol, England in 18, I don't have the date here, I want to say 50-ish, 40-ish, that time period, ended up caring for over 10,000 orphans, started schools, 117 of them, that ended up educating 120,000, probably that's a conservative estimate of orphans. My wife wanted me to mention Ezra Eliza Hamilton, who started the first Christian orphanage in New York City back in 1812-ish. I'd be guessing at the year, but right around there. Who started the first orphanage in the Northwest? Anybody know? The Sisters of Providence started the first orphanage here. So, of course, my point is that it's been Christians and the Christian church, which in our DNA, we saw this social need that was not being met by others for whatever reasons, and we have this rich heritage as believers down through the millennia of being those that have started these organizations that have done so much social good. A hero of mine in the 1800s was the first to reform the child labor laws. Did you know that in England, children under 10 could work in the coal mines? That just is unthinkable to us. So a statesman, a lord, but a thoroughgoing Christian, the 7th Earl of Shaftesbury, he saw it as his job in Parliament to take on a number of these needed reforms for the poor and the needy, and it was he and others that spearheaded the reform laws that actually made it unlawful for a 10-year-old or younger to work in the coal mines. But those are Christians. Of course, abolition was the movement to end slavery in England and America started within the church. One thing, too, that this Earl of Shaftesbury did was he started to standardize and reform the lunatic asylums. That's what they called them back then. So you would have these spotty mental health homes, really. They were very small. That would be someone would take care of these mentally insane folks in very desperate and despicable conditions in most cases, and they were underfunded. The Earl of Shaftesbury passed a law, or led the passage of a law in Parliament that standardized the care and treatment and helped to fund those mental institutions. Something I wanted to mention, because we are going to talk, obviously, about mental illness quite a bit. So it was Christians that saw that need and responded over the centuries. Let's talk now about... Any questions about that or other thoughts before I move on? I want to now tackle homelessness itself. Okay, the definition of homelessness, I think, is a near useless term. What it tells us is that somebody doesn't have a home, right? Doesn't have a stable place to live. It doesn't tell us anything about why they're homeless or why they continue to be homeless. And if we're going to get to the real solutions, understand the problem, we've got to better understand and address than the causes of homelessness in a particular circumstance. The unfortunate thing in our culture is that you hear so much about this, that what we just need is to provide a stable place for someone to live, and that pretty much ends the interest that the state typically has then in the welfare of somebody who's homeless. But the studies have shown that if all you do is provide someone, you know, four walls and a warm place to live, that may in no way solve their problem. There's the dominant homeless model is called Housing First. How many people have heard that term, Housing First? It actually started with the second Bush presidency, his administration. And the notion was, we got to start getting people off the street into a warm house, but then we've got to address the underlying issues. If it's mental health, if it's addiction, for example, we've got to then address those underlying issues. Over time, however, the effort to address those underlying issues has kind of faded away. And now we have a dominant philosophy, a dominant government approach at the national level, right on down to the local counties, particularly on the West Coast and in New York, where most of the homelessness is, by the way. Now we have this Housing First model that only asks that question, do you have a place to live? And once that's solved, which we're not nearly building enough houses for people who need them, then that's the end of the interest of government. We don't ask any more about whether you're doing drugs, what your mental health issues are, whether you have the skills and proclivity to work, because that's too judgmental. We don't do that because housing now is sort of a right. That's kind of the mentality. Well, we've seen, unfortunately, how successful that particular approach has been, particularly in those states where it's the dominant approach to governmental interventions. It actually doesn't solve homelessness. Some may argue it actually aggravates it. And we have in our country now, a majority of the homeless are in New York, in California, in Oregon, and in Washington. And there tend to be more urban issue. And so the cities that we hear so much about, Seattle, Portland, Los Angeles, San Francisco, New York, and Tacoma, other cities too, that's where we are really being hit hard by the social consequences of homelessness and not dealing with it properly. So I want to just talk then a little bit more about the subpopulations within homelessness. So there's really two, it's a little crude, but there's basically two categories. This is the way that I think of it now. There's financial homelessness. You lost your job, so you can't pay rent. You need to find a new job. Or it could be that you're living in an apartment or in a rental house, and the rent's going up, and your income can't keep up with those higher rents and the cost of housing. So that's a financial thing. It could be maybe a woman who's fleeing from her domestic abuser. That's certainly a form of homelessness. But it's the cause may be a bad relationship, but ultimately it's financial. She needs to get some money together so she can get a down payment and then rent on her own. So I consider that to be ultimately financial. Certainly, there's catastrophes. There are, earthquakes and floods and so forth. But these are all temporary forms of homelessness. And the reason where this person is homeless is essentially a financial issue. It's more and more difficult in places like Western Washington and some of the urban areas in on the West Coast, because, well, I'm not going to go into this, but our land use laws are not keeping up with the need for more housing. Maybe Dave Hanula could, or Hallinan could give us a little short tutorial on that. But what I'm talking about here is not so much the shortage of housing; it's really this category of homeless folks who don't want to be homeless, who want to be housed, and they maybe in a short-term way are struggling to put together the enough funds to take place. And then the second category is the one that we're going to talk about most today and next week, and that is the visible homeless or the chronic homeless. So the people that we see living in the doorways of a business or in the park or on the street, those visible homeless, we should think of them as the chronic homeless. And chronic homelessness is defined by HUD, and I think it's useful, although not certainly entirely accurate or complete, is someone who's been homeless for over a year and suffers from some disability. Well, in most cases, the disability is they have a drug addiction and a mental illness that may flow from that addiction, but not always. Some people are on the street because they've had maybe a lifelong mental illness, schizophrenia, for example, and there's no place where they can't hold a job, and they've always needed someone to care for them, and maybe that caretaker, that parent, is no longer able to do so. So that's chronic homelessness, or the visible homeless. The folks we see, the folks that are causing the most social harms, the folks who are in and out of our emergency rooms because that's the only place they can get actual health care because they don't have stable housing where they can actually develop a relationship with their primary physician and get the kind of medical care they need on a more timely basis. Anybody want to hazard a guess of what it costs our state every year in emergency room utilization for homeless? But you want to just hazard a guess? Is it over? It's over $1 billion a year. That's how much we spend on homelessness. You figure about a hospital or an ER visit's around $3,400 a visit. Homeless folks are in so often that, and there are so many of them, that we are spending as a society over $1 billion. If I had 20% of that, if I could take that 20% and use it, I think, too, and we'll be talking about some of the solutions, we could solve much of homelessness, not all of it, but much of that chronic homelessness. So part of the problem of our system, I don't want to get too much in the weeds on public policy, but a real problem with our system is the fragmented nature in the way that we fund various homeless programs. If we could actually pool that money and measure effectiveness of certain solutions, we would be so further down the road. Let me talk a little bit now about some of the existing services that are out there, and you know of some of them. Shelters, obviously, are a big source of help for those who are homeless. In fact, shelters, our own Tacoma Rescue Mission, and we'll talk a little bit more about what they're doing in our community, they've been around 110 years. Now, they weren't dealing, when they were founded, they didn't deal with chronic homelessness, with drug addiction, maybe a little bit of alcoholism, I suppose. But they were dealing with a whole different phenomenon. They were dealing with people who were out of work. The Great Depression was a period where they really increased their services and because the need was so great. So they were dealing with the financial homeless, as I've used that term. It's not until the last 20 years-ish, 25 years-ish, that the types of homeless that they are now dealing with are the chronic homeless, those with addiction issues, very profound, hardened addiction issues. And when you've lived on the street for over 5 years, these are generalizations from the studies that I've read, and you've lived with the trauma, the victimization that happens to a lot of people who are homeless, certainly women, women who are on the street, they've all been assaulted multiple times. It's horrible to be a woman on the street. The trauma that comes from being homeless will damage you and injure you in such a way that even if you get in a safe, warm home, you're never going to be able to pull it together so that you can independently work and earn a living so that you can afford a place. I've spent a lot of time with these folks. We'll talk a little bit more about some of the things that are out there. And anyone who will tell you, who knows this homeless, particularly this chronic homeless space, if you're out on the street for over 5 years, there's a permanent dependency then that comes with that. So strategies need to be looking at how we get people who are homeless in that first year or 2 years to get them off the street and back into a much more healthy, productive environment. Otherwise, after 5+ years, we'll lose them for the rest of their lives. The average chronic homeless person, again, someone who's been on the street over a year, has a disability, i.e., probably an addiction or some mental illness. The average age of those individuals is 50 years old. What do you think is the lifespan of a homeless man who's been on the street enough years that the average is 50? The lifespan of a homeless person, a chronically homeless person, a man, is 57 years old. The average lifespan of a woman is 53 years old. Now, usually women outlive us men by 10 plus years. But because the streets are so destructive and so harmful for women, they actually die sooner than men do who have been homeless. So shelters are kind of the go-to source of short-term help for people who are homeless. The largest shelter provider in our county is the Tacoma Rescue Mission, a Christian organization that responded to the need of a different form of homelessness 110 years ago. The other largest, or the second largest provider of shelter services is Catholic Community Services. So the church, Christians, have responded in a big way in our town. And frankly, the most effective homeless provider in Seattle, in King County, with the billions that have been spent up there, is the Union Gospel Mission. And they don't receive a dime of government funding. You talk to anybody, they're the go-to people. They know. I was talking to their director, been several years. They know the name. At that time, they knew half of the people by name who were homeless. They're the ones, and Tacoma Rescue Mission, are the ones doing the outreach. And next week, we'll hear from several in our church who are part of that outreach effort, that effort by Tacoma Rescue Mission in particular, who go out night after night and during the day to reach out and make contact and try to build relationships with homeless folks. And we'll talk a little bit more about those efforts next week. Now, the shelters, so I'm just kind of giving you an overall understanding of kind of what we have here in Pierce County and really in other parts of the country. We have shelters that are designed for single parents with their children. You don't want to put that population with single men, so we have different locations. We have temporary housing for, as I mentioned, women who may be fleeing their abuser, maybe have kids. There's short-term housing. By the way, there's not enough of any of this. I hasten to add. But we have shelters that are designed for the unique needs of these subcategories of those who need temporary housing. We even have some really great housing efforts that have vocational training. So somebody who, for whatever reason, never got the kind of skills or background so that they can be gainfully employed, there are several different housing models here in Pierce County where there's vocational training right alongside that housing. So that's what we all instinctively think we want these efforts to look like, where we're teaching people how to fish, not just give them the fish. And so there are those efforts happening for those who have not been on the street for more than 5 years. Again, if you've been on the street for more than 5 years, those vocational training models don't work. Tacoma Rescue Mission has 600 shelter units, and some of it's more long-term housing, so maybe a year or two. They're trying to help people get back on their feet and then ultimately into some sort of probably state or federally subsidized housing. But they have 600 units. Catholic Community Services has about 500, and then there's some smaller providers that maybe have another 150 to 200. So we have around 1,000-ish temporary housing units in a county of 1 million people. It's obviously not enough. One program I'll just tell you about that's encouraging and it's effective. It's called Rapid Rehousing. So we have federal and state and local funds that are pooled for someone who's lost their house, lost their apartment, and they don't have first and last month's rent. But if they're evaluated and you determine if we could just get them that first and last month's rent, they could be properly housed and then be self-supporting. So we have programs that provide that kind of rent. Sometimes it's someone who said, you know, I'm from Alabama. I wish I could get home. I've got a mother who will house me or a sister, and we'll give them, you know, bus money so they can get home. That's a effective solution. So that's Rapid Rehousing. That's a really successful program for those, again, who are temporarily unhoused. And then we have lots of great private charitable programs. Our deacons are constantly meeting with folks who are at risk of losing their house, or maybe it's they can't pay their electrical bills. So it's, with a house, you need to have electricity. So we have in our deacons are doing some wonderful work throughout the week to help people who are struggling financially and need to stay in their house. We've talked about then there's permanent housing. So one of the great struggles with the way we do social service programs for the homeless, as I mentioned, we have all these sort of temporary programs. But the goal, of course, is to try to move someone into something permanent where they don't need the Tacoma Rescue Mission Men's Shelter. They get the vocational training, and now they can afford to live. Well, as we all know, housing costs have become extremely difficult and challenging for many people, not just those who may have been temporarily unhoused. So there's that. But for those who are the chronic homeless that I mentioned, and those maybe who are struggling for other reasons, financially or to get a job or keep a job, we don't have the right place. We don't have the permanent housing. That's what everyone's saying. Well, what do we do if we open the shelter temporarily to take folks off the street during the winter? We have no place to take them once we've got them. They're going to return to homelessness and return to using our emergency rooms in the way that I mentioned. Or you talk to a first responder, a law enforcement, they're saying more and more their calls, their contacts with the public are homeless related. So they're not catching bad guys. They're dealing with some schizophrenic individual on the street who's acting out and is a danger to others or to himself. And so they've got to figure out how to settle that guy down and take him someplace if they can where he's not a risk to himself or others. We don't have that permanent housing that's suitable for the particular challenges that these folks who are unhoused have, particularly those who have chronic homelessness. Somebody with an addiction problem, somebody with a severe mental illness, you stick them in an apartment complex, they don't last because they're even more isolated. You're not dealing with the underlying psychological, emotional issue, spiritual issue. You're not dealing really effectively with their addiction. And a Harvard study that I referred to quite a bit, a 2021 study, found that people who are chronically homeless, who you put in apartment-style housing, have lots of supports, case managers, and people visiting them to try to deal with their addiction issues. After 5 years, only 36% were still housed. The rest were on the street or had died. So the kind of housing that you create for these difficult cases, particularly the chronically homeless, really matter. So that's why the housing first approach often is unsuccessful, because you're not asking the question, well, what does this person actually need that you're getting off the street? The worst thing that can happen is to put them in an apartment style housing where they're even more isolated. Interestingly, one Washington State advocate for housing first still hasn't backed away from that, but he recently wrote an editorial in the Seattle Times, and I thought I would just give you this quote from his op-ed. To my fellow advocates for homeless people and practitioners of Housing First, I implore you to embrace a wide range of practical strategies. Visible homelessness, drug abuse, and untreated mental illness create a sense of anarchy that frightens our citizens and erodes public support that therefore has been strong in Seattle and Washington State. Acknowledging that the Housing First model is really not working and people have are rejecting it and are not going to want to keep spending extraordinary amounts of money trying to create housing that doesn't work. How many chronic homeless individuals are there in Pierce County? So I heard 3,000. So let me just talk about the way we try to count homeless folks. And it's extremely imprecise, as you can imagine. One is every year in January, I don't know why they pick the winter months, but that's what everyone does around the country. In January, HUD requires those who receive federal funds to do a point-in-time count. And over about a 24-hour period, Pierce County, Seattle, Yakima, San Francisco, send out volunteers to try to count the sheltered and unsheltered homeless. Sheltered being those who are probably at the Tacoma Rescue Mission, for example, or other shelters that we know. I've been out on those point-in-time counts, and you go out usually starting at 9 or 10 o'clock at night, and you're out, you know, dark, and it's cold and rainy. but there you do get an opportunity to actually see the plight conditions of folks who are living in encampments or by themselves in a wooded park or something like that. We use that count to come up with our best number, frankly, of how many homeless we have and what their condition is, and it's very unscientific. So based upon point-in-time count, we have chronically homeless around 1,000. I think it's more, but that's what this point-in-time count seems to number. So you're talking to someone, and then you ask them, hey, do you use drugs, or are drugs a challenge for you? And of course, a lot of people are going to say, no, not at all. So those are not counted, in that chronic homeless population number. So, but the best number we have, it's about 1,000. I think it's probably more. Maybe it is closer to 3,000. In King County, point-in-time count, 6,000 chronic homeless. That I know is way under. In the United States, 1/3 of all homeless are chronic homeless. I think this is based on the point-in-time count. And the national number for homelessness is around 600,000. It's probably larger. So even if those numbers are correct, 1/3 or about 200,000 people in our country are chronically homeless, and they're concentrated in Washington, Oregon, and California, and New York. So we've got a profound problem. I hope I've painted that picture accurately for most of you here in our area. How many of you noticed Chuck? Chuck lives underneath the Highway 16 overpass on 6th Avenue. I've talked to Chuck. I know some of you have talked to Chuck. Chuck has lived in this area for about, 6 or 7 years. I used to encounter him over at the Starbucks. Occasionally I'll stop and buy him something and talk with him. But I think Chuck sort of personifies in a very real individual way this chronic homeless problem. He clearly has a mental illness. But I've talked to him when he's been coherent, and we've had, an exchange of actual, meaningful communication. But clearly, having lived on the street, he lies under, on a sidewalk in under a blanket, and that is going to take its toll. In fact, I offered him a coat one time, a really warm coat. And he said, no, it's okay, I don't need it. Give it to someone else, which was really kind of surprising and in some ways encouraging. So we have lots of these checks. We have 1,000 of these checks and Ann's and Susan's that are living on the street, mainly because they have this mental illness or addiction or both. Let me say something briefly about our behavioral health services, because some of you are thinking, well, okay, why don't we just get them into the right, you know, place for to deal with their mental illness or their addiction? Real quickly, I mean, I'm not going to describe all the different flaws and inadequacies, but essentially what we have in our area is a very fragmented system that doesn't communicate well among different providers. They're doing their best, but it was just set up wrong. We have crisis facilities where a first responder can take someone and to a crisis facility to try to deal with their addiction issue or their acting out or some mental illness crisis they're involved in. But once again, we don't have anything long-term to take them once we've kind of stabilized them. We have psych hospitals, some of you know, well found there on the Allen Moore campus, 125 beds, I think. Now it's full. Again, they're doing their best, but that's not a permanent location for folks. Once they've sort of treated them, they really don't have any place then to discharge them to. What's missing? What's missing in this whole system that I've just described? So you've got all these, you've got efforts by the government. We're spending literally billions of dollars in Washington State to try to address this issue so ineffectively. We've got some very fine nonprofits, most of them Christian-based, that are doing their best with some pretty limited resources. What has occurred to you as I've talked about this is missing, do you think? Jesus. You know, from Sunday school when you're 3 all the way up to this adult class, that's the right answer. It's the Lord. And we are going to get to that here. No, we're going to get to that next week. I did tell you it was 2 classes, so we'll get to that. Yeah, 2 classes. We'll talk about sort of the biblical principles behind that. But so sort of obviously the lack of a spiritually driven life with the hope and promise that being born again in Christ provides all of us and certainly is powerful, a powerful need for the homeless. What else strikes you as missing? Right, lack of family. So Lori's getting to one of the ultimate solutions we'll talk about next week. I'm going to read to you an editorial, and maybe we'll leave with this kind of ringing in our thoughts and minds as we think about this over the week. So I'm going to talk next week about, and some of you know about this, what I think is a very effective solution to deal with the chronic homeless that we've been talking about this morning. And it tries, and I think in a very powerful way, creates that family, that sense of belonging, that sense of hope, accountability, that sense of purpose, that sense of dignity. Those are all the things that we want for ourselves, we want for our children, and that is absolutely lacking when we think of the chronic homeless and how they're living their lives. Where is the dignity of living in a tent and doing drugs and being looked at by the rest of us in a condescending way? Where is the purpose? Think how important purpose is in our lives. Think how important accountability is, how we all need accountability. But living on the street is anything but. Let me read you this article. It was actually written in support of the village I'm going to talk about next week. I didn't know it was going to appear in the News Tribune a couple years ago, but I think this captures in a very personal way the challenges of chronic homelessness and where the solutions lie. Stashed in a box in my office, I have stored 27 years' worth of letters from my father. Having spent the better part of his life battling addiction and mental illness, he was often absent from my life, save for these letters. They are a chronicle of his struggles and his triumphs, his dreams and his regrets. And still, nearly 5 years after his death, I take them out from time to time whenever I need to reflect on certain hard truths about life and love and God and mercy. My father may have been a homeless addict for a good portion of his life, but he had an access to a kind of wisdom that still seems to elude me, despite my education and so-called worldliness. In reading his letters as a complete text, I can see the narrative arc take shape. I can see when he is at his most vulnerable, when he is using, and when he is whole. The letters resemble a wave, expansive when he is connected to a community, withdrawn when he is languishing on his own. For many years, my father lived in Washington City Mission in Washington, D.C., or Pennsylvania, I don't know that area, a Christian halfway house that required sobriety, church attendance, and concrete responsibilities to the community for admittance. As restrictive as that kind of life might seem, those were the expansive times. His letters from the mission were often 10 pages long, always handwritten on yellow paper, covering a week's worth of events at a time. They were optimistic, thoughtful, and almost scholarly in scope. It's clear that he spent long hours in reflection and even longer hours in communion with the Word of God and other men at the mission. Quote, "My spiritual life seems to get better each time I come around here," he wrote. Now back to the daughter. It's clear to me in retrospect that community was the only thing that ever kept my father alive. I think about my father's experience every time I drive by a homeless encampment in Tacoma. I can't help but wonder what kind of untapped potential, what kind of hard-earned wisdom resides in each tent. I also can't help but wonder if the power of community could be as transformative for those people as it was for my father. That tent cities exist at all speaks to the fundamental human need to live in communion with one another. So let me leave you with that. That's what we're going to talk about more extensively next week, is this missing piece, this missing critical component of community. We all get it. Our families are our principal source of community. This church is also a vital source of community for all of us. Maybe workmates are also part of our community that provides real purpose and meaning in our lives, a sense of belonging. Those who are on the street don't have that anymore. They may have been close to a family, but due to the breakdown of that family, due to their drug addiction, or maybe their mental illness, or both, they've cut those ties of those families. So that's what we'll talk more about next week. Thank you for listening to me go on, and we'll get to the sort of biblical framework to think about as Christians, how we have, a unique opportunity to speak into and provide the kind of services that and place to live that our chronic homeless neighbors need. Thank you.